563-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Mullarkey.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Thursday already, edition of It's Your Turn. I told you a week or so ago that month, that 4 or 5 weeks between Thanksgiving and Christmas just flies by. And it certainly has this week. You realize we're a week past Thanksgiving already. Yeah. Thanksgiving was last Thursday. Now, the calendar's a little bit strange this year. Thanksgiving was a touch early because it's not often that you're a week past Thanksgiving and it's still November. Well, it won't be tomorrow. Hey, we have a lot of guests on the program today. We love it that way. We had a day earlier this week with several guests, so we'll be bouncing around from one subject to another. We'll meet our first guest in just a moment here. He's a local author. But later on the program today, we will be chatting about a new and, I think, kind of unusual method of helping veterans who are battling post-traumatic stress disorder. We'll be talking with the guest Joe McLean about that. We'll also be chatting about something that I've never heard of, infantile spasms. It's a pretty rare medical condition, and there's Awareness Week coming up. We have a physician who'll be chatting with us from California about that, Dr. Mary Zupants. And some other stuff on the program, too, a little bit later on. But let's say hello to our first guest. He visits with us by telephone today. He is Gary Minner. Gary, nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Dave. Appreciate being here.
Now, there's going to be a lot of people listening to us here in the Butler County area and throughout western Pennsylvania who are saying, Gary Minner, that name sounds familiar to me. They may not know you, some of them will, but they will have heard your name before. You were pretty visible, had a pretty visible home improvement business here in the area, did you not?
Well, I'm proud of what the Minner Company accomplished during my 40-year reign, but I tried to keep my name out in front of the public with advertising and vehicles with lettering all over them.
And now you've branched out into another phase of your life. You have written a novel, the title of which is Maybe Love Likes Crazy. Is this your first novel, Gary Minner?
Yes, it is. I have always wanted to write, but never had the time. And as I was winding down my tenure in the Minner Company, I decided to get into it.
Mm-hmm. And it's just recently published. Where is it available?
You can buy the book on Amazon, Amazon Books. It's available in both an e-book and a regular printed copy mm-hmm. that you can have sent to you. If you like to hold a book, which I do.
Me too. So let me ask a little bit about, it's not unheard of for someone to launch into a writing career as another phase of life comes on. But on the other hand, not everybody does it either. Did you always have an interest in writing? I mean, like even, you know, all the way back to when you were in school?
Well, it depends on how much time you have to listen, Dave, but I could go way back to my early childhood. I grew up on a dairy farm near New Wilmington, PA, and there was no television in our house.
Mm-hmm.
And so reading was your form of entertainment. And so it started out with, again, the love of reading books and poetry and schooling. You know, I learned it all in schooling, really, to read and then to write poetry. And, of course, you have the reading classes and the literature classes, and then you go on to college and it was just all a progression of enjoying the written word, and I always did well in all of those subjects.
You know, it's kind of funny. I had a similar experience, and I'm not a writer and never will be, but I started to read pretty young. Now, you know, everybody, you know, has the Dick and Jane readers whenever they're in elementary school, and, you know, everybody takes literature in high school, but the first really kind of adult material, and I don't mean lascivious, I mean, you know, writing right. for adults, that I can remember reading was I had an aunt who subscribed to something called the Reader's Digest Condensed Books. I have no idea whether they still exist or not, but it was, and I was a kid, so apparently it was some kind of a club that you, you know, subscribe mm-hmm. to, and every few months, again, I don't know the details, they would send you a, they were abridged novels, but there would be three or four of them in this huge book, and she had them, and I, you know, would start reading abridged novels of people that I'd never heard of before. And I think that's where my real start of recreational reading began. And I wasn't very old.
That's fun. Yeah, that's funny that you mentioned that, because my mother was great on books. She had an extensive library when she passed, which she left to my one sister. But there were shelves on her bookcases filled with condensed Reader's Digest books.
They must have been pretty popular. I don't know.
Yeah, I imagine they were. But I'm sorry.
So, I mean, everybody writes a little bit in high school. You know, some people are, it's a natural talent. For some, you do it because you got to do it. I was never particularly thrilled, probably because it was always, it did not come easy for me. What about, you went on to university locally, you went to Edinburgh, right?
Yes, I graduated when it was still Edinburgh State College to be a teacher, and I actually did teach for 1 year at Farrell Middle School.
Mm-hmm.
But I did dabble in writing back in those days, but then a whole bunch of other things got in the way, like marriage and children, and then having to earn a living to support that family, so writing just went by the wayside.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's pretty typical for most people, actually. In fact,
I would admit
there are very, very few people. I have one acquaintance of mine, actually a fairly good friend, who is the only natural writer that I know. And he was, I mean, he was born with it. He has the ability to, he's published numerous novels. And I can remember the first time I read it, I said, Randy, where in the, how did you know to do this? And he said, it just comes to me. And there's nothing else
well,
I can say.
It's not- And I'll say that poetry is similar with me. Poetry just comes to me. I wake up in the morning, and in a matter of 15 or 20 minutes, I can put down 20 lines of poetry on a piece of paper. In fact, my novel has 15 of my poems in it at the back. After you get done reading it, you can read through the poems that I mentioned in the story.
So let's talk a little bit about your novel. First of all, the title, Maybe Love Likes Crazy. When I first saw it, by the way, listeners, if you're joining us a few minutes late here during the noon hour on It's Your Turn, that's fine. Dave Malarkey is my name. Gary Minner, former resident of Western Pennsylvania, is our guest. And he's recently published his first novel, Maybe Love Likes Crazy. When I first saw that title, I said, well, that could be, you know, that could mean a couple of different things. You know, is there someone named Love who likes someone else, you know, named Crazy? Or does it mean that is Love, you know, out of control? Has it gone crazy? Where did you come up with that title?
Well, the that's an intertwined part of the story. The title actually comes from a particular segment of the story where, you know, the two people are talking to each other, the main characters. And so it's just, you know, but the listeners will have to read that part to find out the true answer to your question. I don't want to evade it or anything.
Oh, sure. But, well, we're not going to spill the beans on the whole novel. That would spoil the enjoyment of reading it. Your two main characters, at least I would identify them as the main characters, are Mark Lane and Katie Byler. So tell us a little bit about these people, Gary Minner. First of all, who is Mark Lane?
Well, The story itself is, of course, a love story, a romance about young people. They're only 16, 17, and 18 years old during the story, mm-hmm. but they're farm kids, the one being an English farm boy and the other one, Katie Byler, being an Amish farm girl.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, are neighbors. They don't live far apart. And their families actually socialize back and forth together because they're friends. They're out in the country, and the fact that one family is Amish, one is English, really doesn't keep them from having a family relationship back and forth.
Mm-hmm. So you said you grew up in the New Wilmington area. Did I hear you correctly when we first started talking here?
Yes, I did. I grew up on a 315-acre dairy farm, and we had Amish in our neighborhood. I had Amish neighbors. We did, again, we intertwined back and forth as far as both socially and professionally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'd do carpentry for us. They'd work on our slate roof on the barn. We would, you know, see them at the New Wilmington Livestock Auction all the time. So, you know, they're your neighbors.
Well, that's why I asked. That's why I asked, because I know there was a sizable Amish community in and around the New Wilmington area, and has been for a long, long time.
Actually, New Wilmington is the 15th largest Amish settlement in the United States.
Oh, I had no idea. Wow.
And there's about 5,500 Amish around New Wilmington.
Hmm. We seldom hear too much about them, other than, tragically, whenever there's an incident, and it's usually involving a motor vehicle hitting one of their buggies, and it's tragic because you get one of those accidents about every year or so.
And that is one of the parts of my story. My story came from all of the, or a lot of the incidents that took place while I was growing up, where, you know, I have a very good personal relationship, a knowledge, rather, of the Amish people.
Mm-hmm.
We had Amish young men work on our dairy farm as I was growing. And in fact, they stayed with us. So they were like one of the family. They stayed 12 days out of 14 right there at our farm. They slept in the same bedroom that I did.
Hmm.
And, you know, there was, I had the only bedroom with two beds, and the Amish helper slept in one. I slept in the other. So, I mean, you got to know these people like they were your brother.
Well, it would be quite natural then for you. Some famous writer said, write what you know. I don't remember who said that. But obviously you have great familiarity with the Amish culture, Amish customs, and that fits right in with your novel. Again, listeners, the title is Maybe Love Likes Crazy. Mark Lane is he's a teenager, right?
Well, yes. It starts out when they're only 15, but it zips real quickly to when they're about 17.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark is a laid-back, easygoing fella. He's a lover, not a fighter, except when he gets riled. He doesn't, you know, he will get angry. But the one chapter describes a calamity that erupts when Katie riles him up, and... you know, it's, you know, one of the stories in the book, but he's also a bit of a rebel when it comes to school.
Mm-hmm.
Katie, on the other hand, she's a sweet young thing to everyone but Mark. I mean, that's the thing. She's got a problem with Mark. She doesn't care for him, and it leads to confrontation between them. She's not your typical Amish girl, that's for sure.
But, I'm not real familiar with Amish culture, so maybe you can help me out a little bit. Do Amish girls go to school, or is it just the men who go to school?
Sure. All Amish children go through eighth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And so during the whole story, she's out of school. Of course, Mark is still, you know, he's still attending high school.
I got you. Okay.
But... Mark's also a little bit of a wise guy, and Katie doesn't hesitate to stand up for herself, though. She's got a backbone. And the story, the whole book is about, you know, their personalities sometimes meshing well, sometimes clashing. But she can dish it out as well as Mark can, which is a little unusual for an Amish girl.
So she doesn't really care for him. Obviously, I mean, this is a love story, so he must be carrying the torch for her, huh?
Well, yes, and that all happened by accident. She accidentally started that whole ball of wax rolling when she literally fell on him. And that's right at the beginning of the book, in the very first chapter, that she has an accidental slippage and literally lands on him. So, and that just starts his... it jolts something in his consciousness that then he pays attention to her when he never had before that.
Hey, listen, these things happen when you're 17, Gary, you know.
Well.
you can get a sudden jolt real fast.
Yeah, well, having the, you know, 120 pounds crashing you into the ground, that'll jolt you all right.
Let me ask you referred earlier when I was asking about the characters, Mark Lane, the young man, you referred to him as an English boy.
Right.
Were his family immigrants from England? Or?
Well, now the Lane family had been in Western Pennsylvania he's the seventh generation of his family. But the Amish refer to everybody who's not Amish as English. So that's why he's described as an English boy versus an Amish girl. The storyline is a little bit unusual in the fact that there is the two societies becoming possibly romantically involved here. I don't think you'll find it in too many books where there's an intermingling of romance between the English and the Amish. Usually they keep their separate entities pretty well in the literature.
At least in that area. I mean, you mentioned... it was quite common for working relationships. You know, you get help raising a barn or doing a roof or working on the farm. But in terms of romance and intermarriage, that pretty rare, I guess. Huh?
Well, it's extremely rare. But I chose the storyline because it was different. Than the normal book that you might read about the Amish. But still, it is human. I mean, we're all human. And so to think that they could never be romantically involved with each other or have romantic feelings for each other is extremely unrealistic. They can be attracted to each other. And to me, that was an intriguing storyline.
We're talking with Gary Minner, former Western Pennsylvania resident, now... working to become a successful author. And we're talking about his novel, Maybe Love Likes Crazy. You have set your story in the community of Powder Mills. Is that a fictional municipality, Gary?
Oh, sure. I don't know if there is a Powder Mills in the whole country. There maybe isn't. But it is a fictional small town, and which is the perfect setting for this type of story.
Do you identify it as being in Western Pennsylvania or anywhere specific?
Sure. The story absolutely takes place in Western Pennsylvania. I mentioned places like Pittsburgh and Youngstown in the story. But it's just small town Western PA with our good and bad weather patterns and a lot of the characteristics of the people here, and both the Amish and the what they call us English, come out in the story. So I think the average reader, your listener rather, can identify with what's in this book because virtually it's the story of them. It's the story of all of us here in Western PA.
Well, I think a lot of people who are not Amish have a certain fascination with their culture. And quite frankly, I have a certain admiration, not just a fascination, but an admiration. You know, there was a horrible, horrific story sometime within the past 8 or 10 years. I don't remember exactly when it happened. It was a mass shooting. Just a horrible.
Oh, yeah, sure, thing. Out in Lancaster.
Yes, yes, and several of young girls were murdered. And what happened, a couple of days later, the Amish people of that community came out and forgave the perpetrator, right. The murderer. And I can just remember right. thinking, my goodness, I don't know whether too many people could do that. But anyway, there are many things that I learn about them that I admire.
Yeah. I'd have to find that strength within myself.
Yeah.
I can't sit here and say that I could have that kind of strength. But they do have it, and they're extremely religious, and that's where that strength comes from, is their belief in God.
There was also, and there have been several films made about the Amish. The best one that I can remember seeing was called Witness, and it's probably about 20 years old. It's not a new movie.
But, right, Harrison Ford.
Harrison Ford, yeah. And I'm trying
and Kelly McGillis.
I couldn't think of her name. I knew that she had retired from movies shortly thereafter. In fact, that may have been the last film she made. But
made one last year, I saw her.
Really?
It blew me away. I didn't know that was her.
Wow. Because she's been out of the limelight for years and years and years. Well,
she started in Top Gun right after The Witness
movie. Mm-hmm. But then disappeared from sight.
Yeah, right.
Good movie, by the way, Witness.
It was a very good movie, and it was very authentic, rather very realistic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've seen a lot of Amish movies that were anything but realistic. They're laughable, some of them.
One other thing I wanted to ask you about, and again, my knowledge of Amish culture is limited. A lot of it, I get from the media. But I can't think of the term that they use, but there's a period in the lives of young people where Amish tradition is that they kind of take a break from all of their rules and regulations, and I don't know how to describe it.
It's called Rumspringa, Rumspringa. So Rumspringa.
They kind of run free, and then they decide whether or not they want to, be in this culture for the rest of their lives.
Right. Well, a lot of them don't even bother to engage in that. In fact, I'm sure it's less than 50% of Amish youth actually involve themselves with Rumspringa.
Hmm. Well, that's fascinating.
It's a right that they have, but they're not forced to do it. And I'm sure that their parents would much prefer that they didn't get involved in it.
Mm-hmm. So in your novel, does Katie and the rest of the Amish community, and again, if I'm stereotyping, please correct me, do they wear the classic plain clothes, the very muted colors and plain garments?
Absolutely. Katie comes from what we call old order Amish community. And I would say to you that back in 1966, when this book takes place, things have not changed from then until now hardly at all in the old order, staunch, conservative Amish communities. I still have a friend that I communicate with in the Amish community, one of the workers that worked on our farm. And I question him regularly, and their lives today are not much different than they were in 1966.
Wow.
So, yeah, she comes from a conservative Amish community where any romantic involvement with an English boy would be extremely frowned upon. In fact, she would be shunned, and it would be unacceptable.
Do they still, and again, maybe my knowledge, which comes from mainly from movies, maybe it's inaccurate, do they still not use, like, electricity and telephones and that sort of thing?
Absolutely not. That's what I say. You can look at 1966, you can look at 2017, and they're virtually living the same lives. Now, out in places like Lancaster, they've progressed, and they have propane lighting and propane stoves and propane refrigerators. They do not have that in the Wilmington area.
Well, your young protagonist, your main character, Mark Lane, must have been really smitten because he would have certainly realized all of these obstacles. You talk about beating your head against the wall, falling in love with an Amish girl.
Right. Well, he knew that he had a mountain to climb, and that is discussed in the book, too. But, yeah, he didn't even seriously entertain romantic involvement with Katie. How could he possibly? He knew that either set of parents would squash that in a heartbeat.
Without revealing what happens, do they further age as your novel goes on, or are they still...
Again, the novel ends with them being 18 years of, of age. And the novel itself stands on its own. I could easily write a sequel to this where I take them into adulthood, but the novel is acceptable as all by itself.
Mm-hmm. You know, novels with this theme, now not your particular plot or whatever, but just based around Amish culture, they've been very popular for about the past decade or so, Gary.
I started writing this story actually 6 years ago, and I had no idea when I started that Amish literature novels were becoming popular.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until possibly a couple years ago that someone told me about that, and so it was a surprise to me. That didn't inspire the story in the first place, that this genre was becoming very popular. But it is. It's, in fact, it's the most popular genre in America today, from what I hear.
You can go into a bookstore. Unfortunately, there are not too many of them left, which is very sad.
Yes.
But you can go into a bookstore, and they have whole sections of it's Amish-related literature.
Right.
I talked about 4 or 5 years ago, and I can't think of her name. Brunstetter, I think it was. She's known as the queen of Amish literature. I'm almost sure her name was Brunstetter. Can't think of her first name. She visited with us here on the program. A lovely woman. I don't know, she had written like 25 of these novels.
Right. Well, take Beverly Lewis. I'll bet she's got more than that. Mm-hmm. Like, wow. Mm. Beverly Lewis writes about the Amish in Lancaster. And my golly, she's had 3 of her books written, changed into movies.
Well, again, there have been some pretty good movies that explore Irish culture. Of course, you never know. That's why I ask you about Witness. You never know what liberties, you know, the screenwriter and the director have taken, and, you know, how accurate it really is.
Mm-hmm.
You said Witness was pretty authentic, huh?
It's probably the best Amish movie I've seen. There's a couple of things in there which are a little highfalutin, like the corn burying people. I don't believe that could happen, or that the corn would be at the top of a silo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, growing up on a farm, I know better than stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But they still have to have some type of sensationalism for a movie, so they put stuff in there that isn't authentic.
So you by growing up on a farm, for example, you have one subplot in your book is when some of the neighboring farmers, the Jankowskis, I think, if I can read my notes that I took.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They lost their hay. So that actually can happen. I'm not a farm guy.
Well, I actually took that story from an incident that my dad mentioned at the supper table when I was growing up, and that is that a farmer cut down all his hay, and his brother was going to come in and use the baler, and they were going to run 2 balers to get it all up in one day. Well, it rained for 3 or 4 days in a row, and that absolutely destroys the value of hay.
Hmm.
There's no food value in it left anymore. And so you sell it to the mushroom mines, you know, to grow mushrooms.
You say you grew up, was it a dairy farm, you said, Gary Minner?
Yes, I did.
Hmm.
We had 315 acres. We milked 40 to 50 head of cattle. We had 130 head of cattle altogether. But we milked 40 to 50 cows.
It was traditional, and I know in your book you continue this tradition of most families were rather large by what we would think of today's standards, and one of the reasons was very practical. They needed young people to work the farm.
Well, I had 6 brothers and sisters, and we needed all 7 of us, I can tell you.
There are local references. Again, we're not spilling the beans here. We don't want to, if somebody wants to read the novel, for goodness sakes, we don't want to tell you what happens, but there are all sorts of little local references that made me smile, including a reference to the blue streak. Now, only people who grew up in western Pennsylvania, and actually probably from Butler on north, would know what the blue streak is straight away. Because if you grew up south of Butler in the North Hills or in Pittsburgh, you went to Kennywood. But if you grew up from Butler on north, you didn't go to Kennywood so much. You went to Conneaut, right?
Well, that was a great place to go. When I was a kid, that was probably the most fun I had as a child, was going to Conneaut Lake Park. Just wonderful. And I did what I said in the book. You get off the blue streak and you jump back in the line to go again.
I spent my childhood years in a small town north of Butler, Parker. I don't know if you've ever heard of it or not.
It's oh,
along absolutely. The Allegheny River. But that's where our school trips were as well. We always went to Conneaut Lake. Heck, to go to Kennywood, that was like going on vacation to Kentucky. Right. You know, that was a long trip.
actually, the scariest ride they had at Conneaut Lake was that stupid little mouse.
Yep, I rode that. Yeah, the wild mouse. The blue streak,
yeah, the
of course,
mouse.
As long as you could. It was a homey park. I don't know whether it's still open or not. They've had all sorts of financial troubles recently.
Right.
And
sure.
Some years they had a couple of rides open, and they had some fires up there and a bunch of other stuff. But anyway, I smiled when I saw that local reference. Do you have other local references sprinkled in there, Gary Minner?
Oh, boy. Other local references. Again, I talk about Youngstown. I talk about the Austintown Roller Rink.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. That's what I mean, yeah.
For roller skating. I talk about the interstate and the truck stop, the all-night truck stop. We never had that till I was a teenager. Off the top of my head, I'm having a hard time coming up with another one, but I'm sure there are. My life is sprinkled throughout that book.
I was just going to ask you, honest to gosh, that was my next question. Is there any even a hint of semi-autobiographical people in here?
I've been asked that question a lot of times, and I've refused to answer it most of them. But I will say this, that I refuse to answer that on the grounds that it may incriminate me. But I will say that, our family interacted socially with the Amish, so a lot of the things that happen in this book I learned from growing up. And there's one other thing, and that is that a neighboring farm had a very good-looking Amish girl. And so that did not help, hurt any. Let's put it that way.
I've talked to some authors who, it is a tough question. And sometimes, they're worried about legal ramifications. So they'll say, well,
right.
A couple of my characters are kind of compilations of, three or four or five or six people that I went to school with. Nobody in particular, but just a compilation character. Writing about younger romance is interesting. Not the easiest thing to do, but when it's well done, one of my favorite movies, actually it's one of my favorite movies of all time. It's not a new movie. It's called A Little Romance, and it starred Diane Lane, a very, very young Diane mm-hmm. Lane. She was probably 12 or 13 years old. And Sir Laurence Olivier, one of his very last films that he made. And it was a story of they were young teens. They were, the characters were like 14, 15 years old. And they fell in love, or at least they thought they were in love, and they wanted to go to Venice to mm-hmm. go under the Bridge of Sighs. And that sounds mm-hmm. like a, I don't know, maybe it sounds like a dumb movie. It was so well done. And with this wonderful, uncle-like character of Sir Laurence Olivier in there. I just happened to see it again. I hadn't seen it in years. I saw it last year, and I said, what a wonderful film. And when I was reading your book, I thought about it a little bit,
Well, I'm a romantic at heart. That's all there is to it. That's the type of book that I like to read the best. But being in love is a wonderful thing, but being 18 years old and in love, where the most important thing in each one of the characters' lives is each other, how could it get any better than that?
So plans for a continuation of either this story do you have other novels in the pipeline or in your mind?
I had a couple other projects that I could directions I could go. I thought about writing a book about the founding of Lake Arthur. Again, it would be drama type novel where it would be diagnosing the people that putting Lake Arthur in affected and how it affected them.
Mm.
So I think there's a storyline there for someone to write a book about how Lake Arthur positively and negatively affected the people of the area.
That's interesting. We were just talking about that here on the program a couple of days ago. Someone called about it. It was another question, and I said, you know, when they built the lake, Lake Arthur at Moraine, they flooded a small town. It was called the Village of Isle.
Right.
It totally disappeared underwater.
They also displaced a whole bunch of people who, for the money they were paid for their places, could not go somewhere else and replace what they had. So they were left in a bad way, and that's all there is to it.
On the other hand, we have a gorgeous state park there right now.
Well, we do, and everybody gets to enjoy it.
Yeah.
But there is a smaller number of people who paid a terrible price for Lake Arthur being put in. I was told by one of the local farmers that is right on the edge of Lake Arthur up there when I was doing work for him that there were several local people and farmers that literally committed suicide because of their land being taken off of them.
Oh, I never knew that. Well, boy, you may have a story there, Gary.
Well, that's why I think there is a story there.
What a pleasure to talk with you. I was glad be able to hook up with you. Maybe Love Likes Crazy is the name of the book by Gary Minner. He's listed as G.R. Minner on the cover of the book. And it's available, you said, on Amazon in a variety of different formats.
Yes, it is, and I'd love to see everybody in Butler enjoy it.
Gary Minner, thanks for talking with us today, and a happy holiday season coming up to you, my friend.
Same to you, Dave. Thank you.
Sure. Nice to talk with you today.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Gary Minner. Many people... I did not know him. I knew the name, you know. He had a home improvement company for many, many years. I think it may be still around. I'm not sure, but he's moving into a new phase of his career. Nice to chat with him. Nice to chat with local folks who are doing interesting things, huh? And how brave that is to launch into a new phase of a career later in life. It's wonderful. More to come on the It's Your Turn program today. We need to take a break right now, though, that's for sure. And when we come back, we will have several guests that we're able to chat with. It's one of those days where a lot of our guests had busy schedules, but we wanted to talk with some of them, even if it was only for a few minutes. So lots of guests still to come on the It's Your Turn program here on WISR, and we'll be back right after a quick word. One of our sponsors today is Hearing Aid Service by Kelly. Personalized one-on-one care. If you've realized that you're having trouble hearing, or maybe it's someone else in the family, and that's often the case, where, you know, a spouse will say, don't you have that TV awful loud? You know, where it may be irritating one person, but the other person needs it loud to hear. Or maybe in a crowded room, where it's kind of noisy, you're not able to pick up speech clearly. You can hear noise, but you can't pick up speech clear. Maybe it's time. Maybe it's time. Talk to Kelly. Call the hearing aid lady. We'll give you the phone number in just a moment or so here. It's one-on-one care. Kelly has no interest at all in selling you the highest-priced hearing aid. No. Her interest is helping you to hear better and to be comfortable at the same time, because that's a big deal with hearing aids as well. So many people who have made the change or consulted with Kelly are very happy that they did. And by the way, starts out with a complimentary consultation too. Call the hearing aid lady. Call Kelly. Hearing aid service by Kelly. Phone number 724-756-4327.
Hi, this is Howie Pinckney with Pinckney Capital Management in Portersville. Today, many people need help managing their investments. The investment options available today can be confusing. If you would like to talk to someone for help, why not call me for an appointment? Howie Pinckney at Pinckney Capital Management, 1284 Perry Highway, Portersville, Pennsylvania. My telephone number is 724-368-4224. Securities and advisory services offered through Commonwealth Financial Network. Member FINRA, SIPC, a registered investment advisor.
Listeners, going to be talking about a medical condition. This is important. It's something that I'm not aware of. We had an opportunity to find out a little bit more today here on the It's Your Turn program about infantile spasms and Infantile Spasm Awareness Week. My name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest visits with us on the telephone today. She is Dr. Mary Zupons, M.D. She is a pediatric neurologist with the Children's Hospital of Orange County in California. Dr. Zupons, nice to have you with us here today.
Yes, it's nice to be with you as well.
This is, we're coming up on Infantile Spasms Awareness Week, December 1st through 7th. We'd better start out by identifying just exactly what we're talking about, because I'm sure many of our listeners, like me, have never heard of infantile spasms. What are they?
Infantile spasms are a form of epilepsy that occur in infants, young children, typically between 3 to 8 months of age. Most people think of seizures as grand mal seizures. That's at least what's shown on television, mm-hmm. where someone will drop to the ground and have violent shaking, thrashing of their arms and legs. Infantile spasms are much more subtle seizures. They occur in children between 3 to 8 months of age, sometimes a little bit earlier, sometimes a little bit later, but typically under 1 year of age. And the common signs are repetitive head bobbing or maybe slight shoulder shrugs, eyes rolling up, stiffening of the arms and legs that occur every... They typically occur when a child's awakening in the morning, mm-hmm. or perhaps when they're falling asleep, but they occur every 1 to 5 seconds over the span of 5 minutes, sometimes 30-plus minutes in duration. But parents recognize it as unusual or atypical in an infant. But they can be very subtle and are often not acknowledged or diagnosed quickly by primary care providers such as pediatricians, nurse practitioners, or family physicians.
Is this a
but
rare...
the parents know. Pardon me?
Is this a rare condition, doctor?
Well, I'm a pediatric neurologist, so I see these children all the time. But in general, it occurs in 1,200 children in the United States each year. So to me, that's a large group of children, because it can have such devastating consequences on the developing brain.
That was my next question. That's the concern, then. You want to identify these and then take action, because it can... Is it long-term damage to the developing brain?
Yes, it can. So we've, in Infantile Spasms Awareness Week, we have formulated a mnemonic called STOP. See the signs, and the parents are the ones who know that something's wrong. Then the T is take a video. That can be extremely helpful in showing it to a provider or a pediatrician, a nurse practitioner, emergency room physician, so that they have an example of what their child is doing. Obtain a diagnosis quickly. The sooner you treat infantile spasms, the better the outcome, regardless of the cause, and prioritize treatment. So STOP, stop infantile spasms.
Speaking of cause, is there one, or is it congenital?
There are multiple causes of infantile spasms. I think of infantile spasms as a common manifestation of an underlying brain disease. It can be genetic, for example, a chromosomal abnormality, mm-hmm. trisomy 21 or Down syndrome would be an example. Tuberous sclerosis complex. 20% of all children who have infantile spasms have tuberous sclerosis complex. And those are genetic causes. It can be due to a malformation in how the brain formed in utero. Or other causes could be the consequence of having meningitis or encephalitis, an infection, in other words, in the brain. Trauma can sometimes result in infantile spasms. And then more rarely, there can be a group of disorders called inborn errors of metabolism, where the cells in the body are missing certain enzymes that produce toxins or abnormal compounds in the brain that produce abnormal electrical activity.
And this is important to talk about, especially during this coming week, Awareness Week, because I understand this condition is often misdiagnosed.
It is, unfortunately, misdiagnosed. When parents bring these concerns to primary care providers who may or may not be familiar with infantile spasms, it is often dismissed as colic, reflux, or normal baby movements, normal startles, when in point of fact it isn't. Parents are my heroes because they often know that there's something wrong, and I would encourage parents to be persistent and to take a video. And if they're concerned that their child's having infantile spasms, the greatest library of infantile spasms, believe it or not, is YouTube. They have the greatest samples of infantile spasms that I've seen. And then be persistent. Say, ask their primary care provider if they can have a consultation with a pediatric neurologist. As a pediatric neurologist, I see children who've had infantile spasms for 3 months, 6 months, sometimes 1 to 2 years, never been diagnosed, never been treated.
Is there ongoing research or are there clinical trials or something going on?
There are always clinical trials, always research. I think infantile spasms has been not researched enough in terms of effective therapy, but there are two FDA-approved drugs, ACTH and vigabatrin. In the tuberous sclerosis, with patients with tuberous sclerosis, there is a study that's going on now that's very important for parents to know. It's the first ever preventable epilepsy trial called PREVENT. Many of us researchers do believe that by identifying abnormal brain activity prior to the onset of these seizures and other seizures, we can intervene early and prevent infantile spasms. So this research will recruit 80 infants with tuberous sclerosis complex, and infantile spasms are estimated to occur in 40% of children with tuberous sclerosis complex. And what we'll do is half of these children will receive vigabatrin, a known treatment for infantile spasms, before the infantile spasms occur. The other half will receive placebo, and we'll then track their developmental progression and see if it makes a difference in preventing the infantile spasms or help with their development.
Well, it's important that we talk about this during this Infantile Spasms Awareness Week. I certainly was not aware of it. And it's important that we talk about it in general because I've been told, Doctor, that even as recently as a generation ago, people did not talk about epilepsy. If there was someone in the family with epilepsy, it was kind of hidden away in a closet. Have you encountered that or heard about that?
Oh, there's definitely, there's still a stigma associated with epilepsy. Oftentimes when I'm trying to look at the family history, because family histories are very important in determining an underlying cause for epilepsy, many families don't talk about it, believe that it may be, in some cultures, caused by quote-unquote evil spirits, or if you look at the biblical reference to epilepsy, it was often being quote-unquote possessed by the devil. And in fact, the first reference to epilepsy is in the Bible, where if someone was possessed by the devil, Jesus sent them out to the desert to fast and pray. And the fasting is probably the first reference to what we call the ketogenic diet, which is an effective form of treating epilepsy. But these old mythologies and stigmas of epilepsy persist still in this country and throughout the world. And it's something I really strive in my profession and in speaking to community groups to dispel.
Dr. Mary Zupants, MD, she is a pediatric neurologist. Thank you, doctor. Great to talk with you today about this subject.
Thank you very much.
One of our sponsors on the It's Your Turn program today, the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler. Suddenly, it's the holiday season, right? We were talking about that earlier today. Thanksgiving was a week ago today. Listen, when you're putting your holiday gift list together, think about maybe putting St. Vincent de Paul down there at the bottom of the list. A gift, however large, however small, would be greatly appreciated to help fund their food bank and their client aid program. The volunteers at Society of St. Vincent de Paul work so hard throughout the year, and they really appreciate the help they get from people. Maybe it's just a little extra donation of non-perishable foodstuff for the food bank. That's a nice holiday gift, a wonderful holiday gift. So think about it, and, let your conscience be your guide. It's a nice, you feel better about it, too. We stand the tallest when we stoop to help others. So make a holiday gift on your list for the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler. Food Bank on Elm Street, right at the bottom of Institute Hill. The St. Vincent de Paul thrift stores in the greater Butler Mart, Route 8 South. Coming up in just a moment, our next guest, he is a U.S. Navy veteran. His name is Joe McClain. He's going to talk about a rather unusual treatment to help veterans suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. It's next on It's Your Turn, right after these words.
Hop the bus, leave the driving up to us. We're going your way, getting there starts here. Just hop the bus, easy and economical. Just hop the bus, no car, no problem. The bus will get you there, 'cause that's what we do. Hop the bus, leave the driving up to us. The bus, we're going your way.
Listeners, going to talk about, and this is pretty neat. It's a non-traditional way of dealing with something that I think all of us have heard of and all of us are concerned about, and that's post-traumatic stress disorder, particularly in our veterans. Dave Malarkey is my name, and on this segment of the It's Your Turn program, we're chatting with guest Joe McClain, who visits with us on the telephone. Joe McClain, nice to meet you. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks, Dave. Happy to be here.
You are a veteran yourself, a U.S. Navy veteran, and you are also the CEO of an organization called Help Heal Veterans. Tell us a little bit about this group, Joe.
Sure. Help Heal Veterans has been around since 1971, over 46 years. And we are kind of unique in the nonprofit space in that we are a manufacturer, and we provide the tools that help doctors heal and save the lives of our veterans and active duty military. And we do that in a semi-unique way by providing therapeutic arts and crafts designed from the ground up to help treat things such as traumatic brain injury, PTSD, substance abuse, and help our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines better bond with their families after a long deployment.
So, as I mentioned in my introductory remarks, non-traditional methods of dealing with this, and I'm sure that a lot of listeners, when they first heard you say arts and crafts, thought, wow. And I did, too. And then as soon as I started to think about it a little bit more, my goodness, this technique is used in other ways, therapeutic ways, to help individuals who are suffering from a variety of problems, including brain injury. And many, unfortunately, of our veterans come back from overseas with traumatic brain injury, do they not?
They do, indeed. And typically, not typically, but many times, traumatic brain injury and PTSD have the same symptoms. So a veteran is maybe suffering from both and needs to be treated for both. And if he's depressed, has trouble sleeping, maybe self-medicating with alcohol, these can all be signs, that that maybe not just a mental injury, as it were, or mental trauma, but also physical trauma mm-hmm. for an injury to the brain itself.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any statistics or ballpark figures on the incidence of post-traumatic stress disorder in returning veterans? I mean, everybody's heard of it. I'm not sure that we're all aware of how frequently it occurs.
Well, you know, the VA recently put out some numbers. They estimate that 1 in 5 of our returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan suffer from PTSD. And there are indications that could be even higher for some of the previous conflicts, such as Vietnam, as mm-hmm. well. Mm-hmm. So it is a pretty prevalent and kind of an invisible wound of war. And one of the problems with PTSD and TBI is that, you know, our veterans sometimes will ask for help for everybody except for themselves. So, you know, they may not be willing to go get help, and it's incumbent upon loved ones, family members, to encourage folks to go to the VA, go to the military medical center, go to your doc, and seek out help.
So tell us a little bit about some of these craft activities. Are they specifically designed, Joe, to help veterans deal with the post-traumatic stress disorder?
They are indeed. You know, we, as a manufacturer, and it's a nonprofit, we give these away free of charge to any vet undergoing health care, as well as facilities like major military medical centers, your local VA, state veterans homes, all over, that we're there to help. And we design these from the ground up with the help of a lot of smart docs and clinicians. And these kits range from leather footballs to baseballs to laser models of Apache helicopters to jewelry kits to leather messenger bags to purses to jewelry to art supplies, traditional art such as paint by numbers or traditional drawing and painting type of things. These are all things that are very unique, I think, and are designed not just for fun, but to help with cognitive skills, mm-hmm. Fine motor skills. Be able to concentrate for a set period of time, designed for a vet who's more senior, who may not have any fine motor skills, so we make things that may be a little bit easier to complete, or someone needs something for a therapy, they'll keep them busy for a few hours, something's very complex.
And this would, the specific needs would vary from person to person, and the results, I suppose. I mean, I know of people who relax by painting. Now, they're not professional artists, and they don't sell work, but they find it very, very relaxing. I, for example, if I were trying to assemble a model, that would not be relaxing for me. I can remember doing that when I was a kid, and I got more frustrated than anything else. I was ready to scream.
You know, and
sometime.
That's a great point. We can make things that are a little bit easier always or more complex, but a lot of it is just completing the challenge. And, you know, there are times when it may seem stressful, but you are actually getting lost in the task. Mm-hmm. And by loss of task, you may be able to forget or put aside for a while the trauma that may have caused your injury and kind of get out of your own head and into something else and complete a task. And once you've completed it, you feel more confident. And a lot of our vets, you know, may suffer from self-confidence issues from all things that are going on within their own head. And by completing a small project, it gives you the confidence to take on something bigger as well.
I can, you know, I'm just remembering things from earlier in my life. I can speak to that. Sometimes you finish one of these projects, and there's a great sense of accomplishment. You feel better about yourself.
You do, and that helps for treating things like depression. Or like for some of our vets who are suffering from substance abuse, you know, they need something to keep them busy for a couple hours, mm-hmm. you know, to reach out. Or somebody's for suffering from a traumatic brain injury where it takes a while for the brain and your motor skills to heal up. By doing a project, you know, one after the other, over time it'll take it. And these are injuries that take a long time to heal. And there are a series of small battles. There is no quick fix. And the craft kits themselves can be part of a more comprehensive medical program, including, you know, be it traditional medicine, therapy, talk to your mental health provider, other things. And doing these kits can help win those small battles. And we provide those tools for free to our vets.
And we know that this has proven to help. I mean, I recall reading a Wire story last year about, and this was not specifically about veterans, it was senior citizens, to help those who were fearful of dementia or developing dementia, getting involved in activities that kept the mind busy. I mean, it could be as simple as a crossword puzzle. It could be something more complicated than that. But in fact, I now see advertisements for that, you know, like an AARP and stuff like that.
Yeah, you're exactly right. That's just how versatile these tools are. I mean, we've got things that'll help a young Marine just back from Afghanistan, all the way to the senior you just mentioned, you know, who may need something a little bit different, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, because that's just kind of their challenges are different as they get a little bit older.
What about
you
know, motor skills? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
A medicine that can help.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to jump on you there.
No worries.
What about motor skills? Some of our veterans who come back for one reason or another, it could be a physical injury, it could be something else. The motor skills are not what they used to be, you know, even using your hands and so on and so forth. I'm imagining that this could be beneficial to some of those guys.
You're exactly right. I know there's a vet that, Todd was an Army vet, and he was blown up on IED and subsequently shot in the leg after and then subsequent ambush. And he had the tendons in his right arm severed. And he was in the hospital in Walter Reed for about a year and a half. And by doing it, it was kind of hard for him to recover, obviously. You think he had to coming back, not just an injury to the brain from the IED, but also the injuries to his arm, you know, were the, you know, serious injuries. So by doing, started with paint by numbers, doing other kits, it was a long road, but he's able to improve over a long period of time.
We're talking.
And train those fine motor skills. It wasn't easy for him, but he does credit the craft kits and the art kits with helping him make that recovery.
Joe McLean, folks, is CEO of a nonprofit called Help Heal Veterans. How do people get in touch with your nonprofit, Joe?
Sure. Well, the best way is through our website, healvets.org. We're out here in Southern California. We've been around for 45 years. We have a manufacturing facility, but we're also a service provider. We have folks around the country, volunteers and other folks who help serve in the local community. And the best way to support us, either through donations, is healvets.org. Or if you're a vet undergoing health care or you have veterans as part of your program, be it at a community center, nursing home or whatnot, reach out to us and we can help serve you either at home or at your facility.
One final question. What did you do in the Navy, Joe?
I was a flyer. I flew off aircraft carriers, the mighty S-3B Viking, for many years. Great airplane. Naval aviation is a great career.
You flew jets off aircraft carriers?
I did, sir.
Wow. That occupation, along with bridge painters, seems to be about the most dangerous thing in the world you could do to me.
Yeah, and they're both fairly stimulating as well, but it was a great career. And actually, my son's on active duty in the Navy right now.
Oh, that's great. Our guest, listeners, Joe McLean. He is the CEO of this nonprofit we've been talking about here, Help Heal Veterans. Joe, nice to meet you. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks so much, Dave. You take care, sir.
Sure. So long now.
Bye.
We have information coming up on a rare type of cancer. It's called neuroendocrine cancer. We'll talk with a survivor, Marianne Wayman, next on It's Your Turn here on WISR. Hey, folks, spend this Saturday with the Butler County Symphony, and you could do it all day, kicking off with the 28th Annual Holiday Tour of Homes this Saturday. Anytime from 10 a.m. on, it's a, you know, it's a go-at-your-own-pace tour of homes. See and explore beautiful homes decorated for the holidays. And it's a big fundraiser, too, for the symphony. Tickets are available at the symphony office on the Diamond on Main Street, also at May's Music Shop, or at Meridian Station. And again, starting at 10 o'clock, go at your own pace. And then this coming Saturday evening, same day, it's the holiday concert, Holiday Traditions. The Butler Symphony concert starts at 7:30 at Butler Intermediate High School Auditorium. And you can check with ticket availability either at the symphony office or online at butlersymphony.org. This is one of the biggest days of the year, this Saturday, for the Butler Symphony Orchestra. Welcome to the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. My name is Dave Malarkey. Two guests join us. Our time is very limited, but folks, we wanted to give you at least some information about a very rare cancer. And we have two guests with us to talk about it. Imagine living for 20 years with a cancer, having been misdiagnosed many, many times, Now that's the case of Marianne Wayman. Marianne, nice to have you with us here today.
Thank you for having us, Dave.
Also with us is her doctor, and that's Dr. Hal Gerstein. You were finally diagnosed with neuroendocrine tumors. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, Marianne.
You are.
It's for short, it's NET. Dr.
Right.
Gerstein, what exactly is NET? Can you tell us in layperson's terminology?
Sure, Dave. NETs are tumors that can arise anywhere along the GI tract, from your esophagus, stomach, small intestine, appendix, large intestine, even down in the rectum. It can also occur in some instances in the lungs. These tumors are small, slow-growing generally, but can be associated with devastating symptoms that can affect our patients' quality of life and sometimes even have them land in the hospital.
Why are so many people misdiagnosed? Is this just such a rare cancer, doctor, that some people don't know about it?
Well, it is relatively rare. It occurs in about 5,000 patients per year, but its incidence is increasing because, as you will hear, thanks to Marianne and her group, we're more aware of the disease and making the diagnosis more commonly and better.
Mm-hmm.
It's misdiagnosed because the symptoms that can occur are quite ubiquitous. They can occur in a wide variety of different diseases. The abdominal pain, neuroendocrine tumor, NETs are not the first thing you think of when you have abdominal pain.
Yeah,
diarrhea,
yeah, yeah.
Not the first thing you think of when you have diarrhea. Mm-hmm. Wheezing, not the first thing you think of when you have diarrhea. Facial flushing, not the first thing you think of.
Mm.
You know, with diarrhea, patients are diagnosed with irritable bowel, inflammatory bowel, malabsorption, food poisoning, anxiety, facial flushing. Most women are diagnosed, oh, you're going through the menopause, don't worry about it. Well, it could be a constellation of symptoms here. Wheezes. Most people are diagnosed with asthma.
Marianne, let me talk to you for a second about, because the doctor mentioned the organization that you founded. What is that, and what's it all about, Marianne?
Well, after my diagnosis in 2001, in 2003, we decided to bring awareness of the disease out further. We do educational programs across the country for patients and caregivers. We just started doing physicians and medical professionals as well. We have a website that we post the videos of our past conferences so people can see the world-renowned doctors talk about the disease. We run a hotline that's open 365 days a year, and when patients and caregivers call, they actually get to speak to myself and my husband. So that's a little unique because sometimes when you call the bigger organizations, you're speaking to somebody that's reading off a script. But when they call us, they're actually speaking to somebody who knows exactly what they're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
We want to make it a little bit more personal. We want to bring more awareness of the disease. We don't have a spokesperson like most diseases, so it's harder to get the word out.
So our time is very short here, but I did want to want you to indicate where people can go for more information. Do they get that online or by phone, or how do they do it, Marianne?
Okay, they can go to our website, netcanceraawareness.org. They can also go to a website called lomelo.com, or they can call 866-850-9555.
I know you two are very busy. It's important that we at least get the word out about this disease. Thanks very much for being with us, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
Sure. Our final guest will be joining us by telephone from England on the next segment, the final segment of It's Your Turn for today. She is Sarah Perry. You know, demons and strange and mythical creatures from English folklore have inspired writers for centuries. And Sarah Perry will talk about that. And she writes about it, too, in her literary love story, The Essex Serpent. We'll talk with her in a moment. One of our sponsors on the program today, Cummings Candy and Coffee Shop for the holidays. Have you thought about that? I have. I've given gifts from Cummings in years gone by. They offer corporate orders of custom gift boxes to give to clients and others. You can choose from an assortment of tremendous goodies, chocolate-covered potato chips, pretzels, graham crackers, cherry cordials. You could add a half-pound bag of Butler's own proprietary blend of coffee, the Main Street Roast. What else are they going to call it from Cummings? Hmm? It's roasted right there at their Main Street location. And they have two other locations now, too, at Butler Memorial Hospital and the newest Cummings, Cummings West, on Route 68, right on the outskirts of town, just west of the city. Listen, call Barry Cummings for more information about corporate orders and holiday gifts. 724-287-3287. Cummings has been serving the Butler community since 1905. They're open 7 days a week. Cummings, candy and coffee shop. Listeners, we have a good book and a wonderful guest to talk with on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. My name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest is Sarah Perry, and she is a novelist from England who visits with us to talk about her newest novel and the first one published in the United States. It's called The Essex Serpent. First things first, Sarah Perry, hello. Nice to have you with us today. Nice to talk to you.
Hello, thank you very much for having me.
So tell us a little bit about the Essex Serpent. As I understand it, this was a big hit in the UK where it was published a year or so ago, but this is the first time that you've had one of your novels published in America, right?
It is, yeah. It's the second book that's been out in the UK, but it's my American debut.
Mm-hmm. And yes, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Sorry, so it's set in 1893, right at the end of the 19th century, and it concerns a legend of a mysterious and monstrous beast that used to haunt the Essex landscape in the 17th century, and in my novel it's come back. And so a wealthy widow who's an atheist and a follower of Darwin hears about this monster that's come back, and she goes down to the Essex estuary landscape to find it. And she meets sort of various people there. So it's kind of about fear of the unknown and science versus reason and various other themes.
Tell us a little bit about, because many Americans will not be that familiar with the geography of England, where exactly is Essex? Obviously, it's on the coast. North Sea, English Channel, where is Essex?
So it's in the southeast. It's just outside London, and the novel is set on the Blackwater estuary. So it's where the river, the estuary of the Blackwater, goes out into the sea. And the really important thing about Essex is that it's a joke. So nobody in England takes Essex seriously. They think it's a very boring place full of very vulgar and terrible people. But I'm from Essex. And I know that Essex is very beautiful, has lots of ancient history and wonderful buildings and incredible landscape. And so I wanted to show people what my Essex is like. And that's been one of the great things about it coming out in the UK is people saying, oh, I had no idea that Essex was so beautiful and that it had all this ancient history. So I feel like I've really done my home county proud.
Your novel, The Essex Serpent, won you the Waterstones Book of the Year prize last year. Again, American listeners may not be too familiar with Waterstones. One of the biggest bookstore chains in the United Kingdom, is it not?
Yeah, that's right. It's basically the English equivalent of Barnes & Noble.
Mm-hmm. Yes, a good analogy. Yeah, very good. Okay, so we know where Essex is. Many of us will not know a whole lot about English folklore. Talk a little bit about that, because that's really kind of the inspiration, the baseline for this whole story, is it not? English folklore.
Yes, exactly. So in 1669, a serpent was seen around Essex. Not an ordinary snake, but something a little bit more like a dragon. And it really did frighten people. And you can go to the British Library in London and you can see these manuscripts from 1669 warning people of a monstrous beast with eyes like a sheep and leathery wings. And it's called Strange News Out of Essex. And rumours about these legends, these serpents, have been all over the country. So there's the Lambton Worm. There's Wormingford, which is also in Essex. Sometimes you can go into these ancient churches and find serpents and strange beasts carved into the pews or carved into the ceiling. So it's kind of a big part of Essex folklore, this idea that sometimes these terrible monsters come up out of the washore, they come out of the woods, and they start menacing the villages.
I suppose the most famous one Americans would have heard of, and I realize that it's in Scotland, not in England, but the Loch Ness Monster. I can't imagine any of our listeners not having heard of the Loch Ness Monster. So this is something kind of like that, right?
Yeah, very, very similar. So it's exactly the same idea that over the centuries, again and again and again, there have been rumours of this beast being seen. So the Loch Ness Monster is the most famous because it keeps being seen right back from centuries and centuries ago when a saint saw it, actually. So the Essex one is a little bit more shy and it's never really been photographed, but ideas of it are kind of deeply embedded in Essex folklore.
How did you find out about this legend, which eventually led to this novel of yours? Was it accidental? Did you stumble upon it? Had you known about it since you were a kid?
It was sheer accident. My husband and I are both from Essex, and we were driving around in the Essex countryside, and my husband happened to have been reading a book about Essex folklore and Essex history, and we passed a sign to a village called Henham on the Mount, and my husband said, "Oh gosh, Henham! That's where the Essex Serpent was." And I said, "What on earth is the Essex Serpent?" And he explained about it. And I immediately thought, what if it came back? And we had about 45 minutes left on our journey. And by the time we got home, I'd basically plotted the novel. So it came really quickly once I'd heard the myth.
We're talking, listeners, if you're joining us a little bit late on the It's Your Turn program here, this segment with Sarah Perry. She is an English novelist, the author of, for the purposes of our discussion today, The Essex Serpent. There may be some people who are hearing this, maybe not familiar with the folklore, maybe not realizing just how embedded it is in English and, for that matter, Irish culture still today. And they're thinking, well, what is this? Is this like, science fiction or whatever? Folks, I would not put it in that category. This is, Sarah might be too modest to say this, this is literary fiction. I mean, you've gotten some rave reviews from some pretty famous writers, Sarah, have you not?
I have. I've been really, really fortunate in how it's been received. And one of the things that I feel quite passionately about writing is that sometimes we think that you can either have a gothic novel full of incident and plot and stuff happening and a page-turning book, or you can have a really well-written one. But actually, I think that you can have both. And so I'm a great reader of all kinds of genre fiction. I love science fiction. I love gothic fiction. I love fantasy. But I also love Dickens and Hardy and Bronte. And so I suppose, to me, the ideal book would combine the two things. It would want to please the reader and keep them up late at night thinking, what's going to happen next? What's going to happen? But will also be written in a kind of very edifying and very beautiful way. So that's certainly what I try to do. Whether or not I've succeeded is for the readers to decide. But that's my aim.
Well, there's a special relationship, too, between readers in your native country and readers here in America, after all. We started out as an English colony, and much of the best of British literature, even from centuries ago, remains popular. I just watched a film adaptation of Sense and Sensibility a couple of weeks ago on one of the movie channels here in America, and I could not help but think how brilliant this woman was writing this a couple of hundred years ago. Huh? Pretty amazing.
Absolutely amazing, yeah. And reading Jane Austen now, you know, it's so similar to a lot of the television and the films and the books that are written nowadays. It's about society, it's about manners, it's about the folly of love, it's about parents wanting the best for their children. And so the best fiction, wherever it's from, is kind of universal, you know. It's sort of, it lasts out the centuries because it's about all of us rather than just about sort of, you know, one period in time.
We'll take a quick break here, listeners, and then I want to talk a little bit about Sarah's novel specifically. Don't worry, we're not going to spill the beans and tell you the whole thing, but we'll give you a little bit of information. But I just wanted, as we go to break here, review some of the honors for this book, The Essex Serpent by Sarah Perry. It was the Book of the Year, as determined by British Book Awards. Best Book of the Year by Waterstones, I mentioned a couple of minutes ago. Costa Book Award shortlist, Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction longlist, Dylan Thomas Prize longlist, Barnes & Noble Discover pick, and Indie Next pick for the month of June earlier this summer. So quite a list of honors. We'll pick up our conversation with Sarah Perry here on It's Your Turn on WISR. Be back right after these words.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick 2 is 5151. The pick 3, 424, 424. The pick 4, 8299. The pick 5, 08275. Wild ball is 2 for each of those. Treasure hunt 5, 12, 22, 24, and 28. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $30,000.
Did you know that Pennsylvania leads the nation in auto collisions with deer? Not a surprising fact if you live in Butler County. It's obvious that your car and the deer are damaged, but what about you? You may have injured your neck and not know it. An impact of only 8 miles per hour is enough to cause soft tissue damage and mild whiplash, which is not uncommon after striking a deer with your vehicle. If this happens to you, visit Applewood Chiropractic Center today for treatment of acute and chronic whiplash. Applewood Chiropractic Center, Thorn Apple Drive in Butler. Call 724-283-0518.
That frightening sound is one we hear quite often throughout the day. Our heart quickens and immediately we wonder what happened. A medical emergency can be frightening. Every tick of the clock crucial. And that's why Butler Ambulance Service is dedicated to be there with every ounce of care possible. Butler Ambulance Service is within minutes of providing you or a loved one with treatment and transportation. Call 282-9595 to find out more. Butler Ambulance Service is a phone call away from serving you.
Welcome back. Dave Malarkey here on the It's Your Turn program on WISR. We're chatting today. Long distance indeed, across the Atlantic, with Sarah Perry, author of The Essex Serpent. You know, as many times as I do interviews, and I do a lot, actually, with folks in Europe, it's still amazing to me to think that, you know, you and I are talking across the Atlantic Ocean, and for goodness sakes, it sounds like you're in the next room, you know what I mean?
It's extraordinary, isn't it? We really do live in the modern age.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Okay, a little bit about the plot line of your book. Obviously, we've established that the Essex Serpent is a critical part of the entire plot. What about your characters? Tell us a little bit about Cora Seaborn, the widow who figures prominently here, Sarah.
Well, I really wanted to write a female character who behaved in the way that women did at the end of the Victorian age. So we have a lamentable tendency to think of Victorian women as just sort of constantly passing out on a chaise lounge in the front room and having to have smelling salts administered to them. But actually, by the 1890s, Victorian women were involved in politics, in social justice, in trades unions and labour laws, in medicine, in science, in maths, in engineering, in geology, in all kinds of fields of life. So Cora Seaborn is a widow who is very, very interested in the sciences and particularly paleontology. So when she hears about the Essex Serpent, she thinks, hang on, this may be a living dinosaur. It may be part of the fossil chain. It may be a great scientific discovery. And she dreams about having her name on a brass plaque in the British Museum next to a huge skeleton. And so I think some readers have found her a little bit challenging because they've said, this doesn't seem like a Victorian woman, but it's because we have forgotten how full of agency and full of interest and full of intellect Victorian women actually were.
And she is a relatively new widow, correct? And actually not all that unhappy to be a widow. She wasn't very pleased with her marriage.
No, so it's evident, although I didn't write sort of scenes of abuse, but it's evident that her husband was emotionally and physically abusive. And so to be freed from her marriage enables her to be free from the conventions of marriage, from the duties of just being a wife and mother, and able to kind of explore other aspects of her personality that she's had to suppress over the years.
Oh, and she was a mother? She had children?
Yeah, she has a child called Francis, and he, I wanted to write about, I suppose nowadays he would be diagnosed as having autism, and so I'm very, very interested in how people would have responded to children on the autism spectrum at a time before diagnosis. So he is quite a strange child in some ways, but of course they have to adapt to him without being able to label his behaviour. And so her relationship with her son is quite conflicted, but I think in the end, I hope, ultimately fairly moving. But yeah, he was an interesting character to write.
So again, you have set your novel in the Victorian era, which would be, well, in your case, late 1800s, correct?
Yeah, 1890s.
Mm-hmm. And she moves, after her husband dies, she moves from London to Essex. How does she find out about the serpent? I assume that she had not known about this previously?
No, she had no idea. So she goes down to a town called Colchester, and Colchester is in Essex. It's still very much as it was when Cora Seaborne visited it, but it's also one of the oldest towns in the UK. It was an ancient Roman town. And it actually had an earthquake in 1850. Extraordinary to think of England having a major earthquake, but it did. And she goes to Colchester and she sees the ruins after the earthquake, and there is a cripple sitting there, a man who's lost both his legs. And he's one of these people that loves to tell a tall story. And it's he who first tells her about the Essex serpent. And a little like I reacted with immediate interest and passion, that's how Cora reacts. And she immediately thinks, I must go down and find it.
I had forgotten momentarily that, there was a time there, late in the Roman Empire, where England was a part of it. As far north as Hadrian's Wall, right? Caesar's army never got any further north than that.
Yeah, they didn't like the weather up there, I think.
That, by the way, is pretty close to the current border between England and Scotland. Hadrian's Wall, obviously, Essex, much further south. There's another character that we should mention, however, just to give our listeners a little bit of an idea of the people that they'll meet reading your book, The Essex Serpent. And it's a local vicar, a man of the cloth, William Ransom. Tell us a little bit about him, Sarah.
So Will Ransom is a relatively young man in his late 30s, early 40s, who was very promising when he was young, very intelligent, but he chose to devote his life to the church. So he is the pastor, the vicar of the little church in Aldwinter, this tiny village. And what I wanted to do was to create a Victorian minister who was not a kind of boring, fundamentalist, sort of anxious man of the cloth like you tend to get in novels, but a really interesting, rational man.
Mm-hmm.
So when he hears about the Essex serpent, what worries him is that it's superstitious. And he says to his flock, you're all having nightmares, you're all getting in a terrible state about the prospect of this serpent. If you had a rational and a sensible faith, then you wouldn't need to be getting in sort of quite such a state about it. So what I wanted to do was to question the link between religion and rationality and science and faith, and to say, here is a person of faith, but actually he's one of the most sensible people in the book. And he meets Cora, and they have a relationship which is a real kind of intellectual passion that sort of builds and becomes sort of more complex and more conflicted as they kind of fight over what the Essex serpent is.
Well, there, listeners, the stage is set for what sounds like a pretty good story, huh? Do we learn a little bit, Sarah Perry? We're chatting with author Sarah Perry. Do we learn a little bit about the geography, the topography of this part of England in the course of reading your novel?
I certainly hope so. I wrote it in real time. So the novel is set between February and November, and I wrote the section set in February during February and the section set in April during April. And I went down to the Essex coastline, which is not far from where I live, and I sort of sat in bird hides and walked around nature reserves and went out on a boat to try to accurately represent what the Essex landscape is like. So hopefully American readers will find it quite strange and different to read about saltings and shingles and marshes and, the very, very specific landscape that I grew up in.
What about the times? Obviously, you're going to be offering some description, too, of this time in English history, the late 1800s, the latter part of the 19th century.
That's right. And one of the things that I found really, really exciting was to try to write about the age as being as modern as it was. So I didn't want to write a typical Victorian novel full of coach and horses and pea soup or smog and urchins in hobnailed boots and men with stovepipe hats. I wanted to write about a modern Victorian age. So by the time the novel is set, the London Underground had been running for 30 years.
Oh, my, I didn't know that.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so the London Underground has been running since 1860-something. And you could have a tooth taken out under anaesthetic. You would be reading the same newspapers that are available now. There was electric light running in London. It really was a very contemporary age. You know, you could drink a pint of Guinness, which you can still drink now. You could read Vanity Fair magazine, which is still going. So what I did was reject a lot of the old-timey Victorian theme park stuff and focus on the ways in which the Victorian age was more modern, which was enormous fun to do.
Oh, that's splendid. And I'm certainly glad you talked about that because I had a different frame in my mind as well. So makes me more anxious. I've got a review copy of your book. Unfortunately, it just came a couple of days ago, and I haven't had time to really get into it yet. I've started it. Listeners, our time is about gone here. We could chat much longer. Delightful chat, actually, with Sarah Perry. Just a little bit about her before we wrap up. She, as she said, was actually born in Essex, lives now in Norwich. She has a PhD in